Welcome to Battle Ready. I'm your host, Ricky Chavez. I built a show for people who lead under pressure and who still choose growth when life forces a pivot. Today, my guest, Alan Cheeseman, Command Sergeant Major, retired 25-year U.S. Army leader, and now the owner and author of Alan V. Cheeseman's Epic New Worlds. He's also writing an epic post-apocalyptic military sci-fi series, Phased World, A New Beginning. I'm glad you're here, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
You know, before I get into the mission, I want to start simple and personal. You know, I know you were telling me earlier about starting early in the military as a air traffic controller. Past that, you know, what made you join the Army?
That's a great question. My stepfather, my entire family is military, has a military background. Stepfather was currently serving at Fort Bragg. He was the NCOIC, the Green Ramp there at Pope, back then it was the Air Force Base. And so I knew the Army's where I wanted to go. Senior in high school, recruiters walking down the hall in the high school, and I chased him down. It really made his day.
I bet. So,
and air traffic control was the hot thing at the time because it was the backfill because Reagan had fired all the air traffic controllers, like I told you, and the military got out. And that led me to Germany, where I met my wife in my unit of assignment over there. And as I mentioned earlier, I was dating the first sergeant's daughter. So I was either crazy or really bold.
Right.
And, that led to a decision to make the Army a career, retrain into air defense artillery, and ultimately in 1989, be selected for Army recruiter, which was the most of my rest of my career through retirement.
Okay. So, you know, we were in Army recruiting probably at the same time. That was very interesting. Nobody wakes up in the morning wanting to go in the Army. We're a recruited force, right?
Right.
So there was a lot of personal discipline that we look for in the recruiters. And as a leader, you know, it's kind of hard to motivate somebody into taking control of themselves. What did you find was one of the biggest challenges with that?
When I joined the Army or?
When you were working as a leader in recruiting and you were motivating the recruiters who didn't choose to be recruiters, but came to recruiting command most times by non-choice, you know, went to the recruiting school. And I used to teach at the recruiting school and I used to get them there and they just did not want to be there because they wanted to do the Army thing, right?
Right.
Now we're as leaders, we're having to motivate them to motivate themselves, you know, to go out there and do the job. What was the biggest challenge you faced, you know, as a leader in recruiting?
Well, I'll lead that off with my platform week experience, and then I'll go from there.
Sure.
So I'm not sure when you went through the recruiting school, but Sergeant Major Quigg was the commandant at the time there at Fort Benjamin Harrison.
Right.
And when he came on the platform, we had 40 recruiters in the class, 40 detailed NCOs, non-commissioned officers. And he came in and he handled that first off. That was the very first thing he said. He said, everybody in here who raised your hand, enlisted, re-enlisted, raise it and let me see it. And everybody raised their hand, of course. He said, now, every one of you volunteered to be here to be a recruiter. So I don't hear any more complaining. I get to work. And he walked off stage. And that was it. So for me, when I met new young non-commissioned officers that came to the recruiting station or to the company, to the battalion, you know, the Indianapolis battalion. And in the battalions I was at the command sergeant major of, I always made sure I sat them down and went through my leadership philosophy with them, but also found their motivation and their drive. They didn't want to be there. And a lot of them had just come back from rotations. You know, we did, you know, 20 plus years in Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and so on. And so we had to find a way to look at how this would help them in their career, how it would, you know, make them more promotable, and how they could have a quality of life without going out on deployments. They could actually build some time with their families while they're in recruiting command. And, you know, as you know, each individual has their own motivations, their own desires. So you had to use that to help motivate them.
You know, the interesting thing, if I can recall, I think I went to recruiting school around 87, and I actually taught at the recruiting school in 95. And, you know, the transition, and I was out of the Army before everything happened. I was non-deployable, so it was my choice in 2002 to go ahead and retire. But I remember it's a lot different. It was a lot different back then than now, and even different probably in the center where you were at to now. And the individuals just, man, I remember, like I said, getting the new students at the recruiting school, and all of them wanted to figure out how they could get out. And now it's like, you know, we reach out to recruiting stations, and it's like sometimes it's a struggle to get a hold of recruiters, which I can't fathom. And what are your thoughts on that?
I actually had a chance to experience that post-retirement. General Bostic, the command general at the time when I retired, a recruiting command, put together a senior leader graybeard team where we had 11 recently retired command sergeant majors, two recently retired brigade commanders, I won't give names, and a retired company commander. And so our job was to help shorten the learning curve of leaders who just got into position. Because as you know, company commanders, battalion commanders come out, they have 2 years in position, and they really don't know what they're doing until the 18-month mark. And by then they've already got their new assignment and one foot out the door. So our job was to go in and shorten that learning curve, be that right seat ride, that mentor, to show them what right looks like and get that window down to a 90-day window so they can be more effective in their position. But in that role, I had a chance to go into companies, you know, with first sergeants and sergeant majors, and see, you know, back then at the time, they had just changed the duty day to end at 5 o'clock, which, as you know, from our experience, was usually, you know, oh, dark 30. Once you got right back from taking applicants to the MEPS or coming back from a late appointment or whatever. But anyway, so at 4:30, I'm in a station with a company, first sergeant, and I think it was Little Rock, Arkansas. And the recruiters all came in, they opened up their lockers. They had lockers next to their desk and commenced to putting on the PT uniform. And I'm like, first sergeant, this is getting into prime prospecting time, you know, telephone time, you know, the P1 as we know it.
Right.
And I said, what are they doing? He says, sergeant major, you know, they're getting ready to go home. You know, you can't work a soldier past 5 o'clock without a risk assessment signed by the first 05 in the chain of command. And we'll get into that later on, why that came to be. That's sure. Very important. But at the time, you know, you're right. The recruiters didn't really have the mission mindset that you and I were indoctrinated to have when we went through the recruiting school. You know, mission was first and foremost. And we'll get into that later on, too, when we start talking about leadership philosophies and the toxicity of the command at the time that we went through it.
Right, right.
Getting into specifics on it. But
well, I'll say this, you know, when it was time for you to hang up the spurs, hang up the uniform, what were your thoughts then? How was your transition?
Mine was unique, as it is for each individual. At the time, I was the command sergeant major of the Beckley Recruiting Battalion, which has since been reflagged Richmond Battalion. And, you know, I had a young family, kids were still in school. And at the time, you always worry, if you've done this for 25, 30 years, you know, this is all you've ever known, and you worry what you're going to do when you make that transition, you know, because you have to get a civilian job, right? You have to go to work. Right. You can't just go home and sit, not unless you won the lottery. And so I actually pulled my retirement twice before I was actually sure. And the wife has been very humble, very graceful, has not told me I told you so, but she told me it would all work out. She didn't want to stay in West Virginia, so we came back to our home here in the San Antonio area in Texas. And moving, coming and going to this area, it worked out where all four of our now adult kids graduated from the same high school. Don't know how that happened, but it did. And it was the right time. It was the right decision. And we primarily did it for our youngest son, who has dyslexia. And the school systems in West Virginia did not have the support for him. So Kamal County here in Texas had what he needed. And now he has 3.5 years of college under his belt. So it was the right choice.
You know, the interesting thing, and you said it right, you know, one of the things that I like to share with our audience is, you know, people don't totally grasp the sacrifices of not only the soldiers but their families. I know my son going into the ninth grade had been to 12 different schools, and you know, that makes them very adaptable, but it still makes it very difficult emotionally, you know, for the kids. And that, and naturally as parents, you know, that we grasp into that. But you definitely did a great thing by moving them there. So now that you're out of the uniform, what do you most want them to understand about who you are now?
My kids or?
No, just the audience.
The primary thing I like to have people take away from meeting me and working with me is as my passion to help people. You know, I'm sure as you still do, there are still soldiers that follow me that reach out for help. I mentor, you know, young soldiers I meet daily, whether it be on social media or in life, help them get ready for their promotion boards, talk to them about their evaluation, you know, reports, talk to them about taking care of families, you know, exceptional family member problems and such. Because as you get to, you know, the senior ranks, you always have a connection. You always have a network. You know who you can reach out to help someone if they really need it. And if you don't know the right answer, then you know the right people to put them in touch with, if that makes sense.
100%.
So
it's all about, you know, I'm in real estate now. And the funny thing we always say is, you know, they always ask me, Ricky, do you have a painter? Do you have a this? Do you have a, I always say, I have a guy, my guy for whatever it is.
Right.
You know, and like yourself, I'm sure when you're coaching and mentoring these people in the different careers and even, you know, transitioning out, you have like resources for them.
Yes.
What are some of your best resources?
The sergeant major that I know, the senior leadership that I know, you know, as aside from what I do in writing and in life, I'm also very involved in social media. Since 2014, I've been an admin for the Command Sergeant Major Sergeant's Major Forum on Facebook. There's about 6,400 senior leaders in there, including former Sergeant's Major of the Army, senior enlisted advisors to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, nominative level Sergeant's Major all the way down to battalion, including current students of the Academy, new selectees, and so on. So the network continues to grow. And so if I need something, if I need a resource, just like any other Sergeant's Major in Sergeant Major in that group, they can say, hey, I got this situation. I have this soldier. This is what I need. Does anybody know who's the sergeant major at this unit? And then we can narrow it down and go offline and we can get the help that that individual needs or whatever the task is to get it accomplished.
Do you have any additional resources like outside of the military that are, you know, former veterans that have excelled in what they do that you feel can help? Other than your sergeant's major's group?
Yes. So you always have your retiree network. And I have a lot of my classmates from the Sergeant Major Academy are in the San Antonio area. So in the case, you know, you were talking earlier about you writing a book and a manuscript. And I have several friends, you know, that went on and wrote, you know, whether it be self-help type of leadership type books. There's one friend I have who's currently an instructor at the Sergeant Major Academy. And I'll put his name out there, Noel De Jesus. And he publishes, you know, bite-sized, like 20-minute reads of leadership, you know. And I have other friends that have written books. So I'm gonna refer those people to you so that way you have connections so you can start, you know, comparing notes and see how they did things because you're writing that type of a genre and I'm writing science fiction.
Sure.
Each publication path is going to be different. Each audience is going to be different for that. Each marketing, you know, plan that you have for that is going to be different. So that's just one aspect. And then every first Saturday of each month for this area, for San Antonio, I gather all the E9s, you know, the enlisted, you know, sergeants major, senior chiefs for the Air Force, sister service type E9s, and we get together at local restaurants. And it's no agenda. There's no script. It's just we get together and we talk, break bread, have a great time, and continue to build our network and help each other. So that way we have those resources you're talking about. If we need to do something, we know a person, you know?
Well, now, you know, next I'm going to connect leadership in the military to leadership and creativity, because building a world on a page still takes discipline and strategy and emotional control. You know, we're going to also talk about the transition in life after the Army. We'll be right back with Alan Cheeseman. Stay connected to this show and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand, anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. If you're on the move, catch the podcast version on Now Media at www.nowmedia.tv. You know, as we talked earlier, I'm here with Alan Cheeseman. Alan, you know, you talked about all of the groups and all of the resources you have together in the Sergeants Majors group in the San Antonio area and nationwide. How can somebody reach out to you and continue a conversation with you or maybe get some guidance if they're a veteran transitioning or a veteran that's already out looking for some help?
Well, I'm available on most of the social media platforms, especially on LinkedIn. I do participate in a lot of different conversations out there. I can provide an email now, or we can provide it later at the end of the show if you like, or which would you prefer?
I think we can also pull up your LinkedIn. I think, Paulo, you have access to that. All right. There's one of them right here. We'll talk a little bit about your books also. That's going to be amazing. And then is this one of the places they can reach out to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you'll today, all they have to do is DM you and you guys can start a conversation.
Yes, I'm on X, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook. I actually have an author Facebook page out there, Threads, Blue Sky. You name the social media, I'm pretty much on it. Wow. Except for TikTok. I don't do TikTok.
Okay, I didn't even know it. You know, I'm still trying to get this social media place down. But now, I've seen in leadership break people down when they don't have a place to process what they're carried. I've also seen people heal by building something meaningful. You're doing that through writing, specifically epic post-apocalyptic military science fictions. Talk a little bit about what made you get into that.
For science fiction, it goes back to my love of science fiction and reading. I'm an avid reader. And one of my favorite authors, S.M. Sterling, Stephen Michael Sterling, he writes alternate history type of books. And so he has one, it's the Emberverse series, a 17-book series. First book is Dies the Fire. If you remember an NBC show a couple years back called Revolution, it was a ripoff of his show. Pretty much, you know, everything electric in the world stops for no unknown reason. And, you know, batteries don't work, flashlights don't work, nuclear reactors, you know, glow. Kinetic energy doesn't work, steam engines don't work, gunpowder doesn't ignite. And so you take that type of a world and you reshape how society breaks down and how factions grow together and the characters that survive through that. So I love that. And so in 2017, a long time ago, I actually had a concept come to me that was, it was so fierce, burning in my head. My wife said, shut up and write the book. So I did. And it was like Christmas time. So I'm up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning, hammering away at the keys, not knowing really what I'm doing. And pretty soon I had, you know, a collection of about 20 chapters put together. And that goes into a different story about the process that I learned from there. But to answer your question, that's what drove me to it. And also at the time, having been retired from my federal service job medically and, you know, trying to keep myself busy, I went and completed a history degree. You know, and we're in the military, we always push our soldiers to better themselves, you know, Sure. Complete their education. And I was the guy that told everybody what to do to get them to do it, but I never took care of myself. So I did that. So I went to University of Texas at San Antonio, completed a history degree. It was a great experience. And that process of learning how to write in Chicago style for history papers actually helped me in my writing style for what I'm doing in my science fiction series. I was doing both at the same time.
Okay.
And so that kept me motivated to keep going, because one thing that I'm kind of going off on a tangent here. One thing that you hit on, when people retire from the military, it used to be the mortality rate was 5 years post-retirement to be in the ground. Because once you've gone so hard, so long, so fast, 25, 30 years, 35 years, whatever, you know, deployments, once you've done that and all of a sudden you go from that speed to stop, how do you recover from that? Is your body's trying to adjust, your mind's trying to adjust, your life, your family's trying to adjust, you being back home. And then if you don't have that type of structure that you had in your daily life in the military, because everything was planned out, what do you do? What motivates you to get out of bed each morning? What makes you get out of bed and continue doing physical training? You know, what do you do with your time once you get up? And that can have a profound effect upon your self-confidence, your self-esteem, your sense of worth, if that makes sense.
No, for sure. So what military leadership habits helped you write consistently, and what habits did you have to unlearn?
For the habits, I'm going to take that back to my time in recruiting command, which was 19 years in uniform plus 2 years as a defense contractor post uniform. And you remember the phrase of plan your
right.
That was hammered on us from day one. We got into the recruiting course. And if you didn't have a plan, then you planned to fail.
That's right. So
in writing, you know, I can tell you that I've written military and government documents for over 31 years. And when I started writing science fiction, I thought that I could write. This is easy stuff. I've done this. But writing science fiction, writing fiction, nonfiction, is a culture in and of itself. There are so many different quirks and nuances. There's a whole process that's involved with it. You've got to learn how to write, you know, the plot, the structure, the track, the character arcs, you know, all the different things that you have to look for to make the story work. And you have to plan that out. You know, if you're, there's two different types of writers, and you've heard probably the term before, pantsers and plotters. Pantsers are like the Stephen King type of writers, where they sit down, they have characters, they throw them into a situation and just follow it and see what happens. You know, put them through hell, see who survives, because not everybody's going to make it. Or you have the plotters like myself. You know, I'm so used to writing, you know, operations orders, military plans, you know, marketing plans, you know, the mission accomplishment plan. Remember that tool, the map?
Sure.
I bet you could still complete one, right?
Man, I don't want to, but sure could. I use it all the time, actually, now.
Yeah. But that's what I'm talking about. It was so indoctrinated into us to have a plan that you've got to have that. And you've got to do that in writing, because otherwise you're never going to get to the end. You're always going to be continuing to, like I'm right now, I'm doing an editing. You've got to learn, how do you move beyond that and get to the end of the story? Otherwise, you'll be revising and editing forever, continuing to polish it and never get it out. And then the only way to really make sure that you're writing what's effective is to get it in front of people that want to read it and get their feedback. They're either going to like it or they're going to tell you it sucks. And then you learn from that. Don't take it personal and make it better. I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. And you know, as I listened to you, as we talked, you know, I told you that, you know, I've been pounding away at what I'm trying to put out as a book in regards to real estate. It's not one of those, hey, follow me, learn all these ways to make millions of dollars. It's more of it's kind of a unknown land here, right? It's like you said, the map, right? We dealt with the map. Out here in real estate, they tell people build your plan and work your plan and make it, but they don't teach them how to plan. What we did in military recruiting is we taught them how to make a plan, and we were very specific about it. You know, and as they worked their plan, then we made adjustments. It's hard to make adjustments on something you don't really know. And so that's kind of what the book's about. But I just been hammering away. I got all these chapters, and to be brutally honest, I don't know what to do with them.
That's the part that is that had me confused for the longest time. You can write, you can put together all this great information, but how do you get it to the point where it's published? How do you get it to the point where you get it in front of your readers? You know, is it something that, and that's the other thing you have to make a decision about. Is it something you just want to accomplish and get it out there and say, hey, I wrote a book, it's out there, I'm trying to help people? Or is it something you're trying to make income from? Because that's two different types of motivations.
Sure. You know,
for myself, for my book, and we'll talk about my co-author that I have and how that came to be, Annette Ilaraz. We're both writing this as a hobby. It's not something we're doing to make income. It's something we're doing that's just for fun, which makes it fun. I have author friends who do this because this was their second career. You know, I have a great friend, don't know him personally, but through interactions and his mentorship. There's a retired major from the Marines, Craig Martell, and he's written, I think, close now to 200 books. I mean, this guy's a writing machine, but he always helps others. He mentors others. He co-authors books. He used to run a group called 20 Books to 50K. The concept was, if you write 20 books, you can get to $50,000 income, you know, monthly or annually. So
I will keep those in mind. We can get ready to bust into a commercial fast. We'll be right back with Alan.
Okay.
Welcome to Welcome back to Battle Ready. You know, a lot of people think resilience means push harder. I don't buy that. I think resilience means learning how to live with honesty and still move forward. Now, Alan, you're a medically retired 100% disabled veteran. How did that change your relationship with strength, purpose, and identity?
It was significant, I can tell you. It was a significant emotional event. I've always been that type of atypical, you know, person where you're mission focused, you're driven, you're purpose driven, and you're running 100 miles per hour, and you're giving 1,000% to what the task is at hand, which is what I was doing post-retirement. You know, retiring from the Army, I did 2 years of contract work for the Army Recruiting Command as a senior leader trainer, and also helping teaching recruiters and leaders how to use their applications. But I landed a position in Strategic Communications Directorate at Headquarters Army Medical Command. And this was around the time of that Fort Hood shooting, that unfortunate tragic event. And it was a test bed where the Command General of Army Medical Command put together a marketing team, a protocol team, a whole bunch of other different skill sets to try to make a strategic communication cell for MedCom. And things were going great. I did that starting in 2000, in 2009. And by 2012, my wife had developed breast cancer. We had talked about that. It took an entire year for her to beat that decisively, which she did, thankfully. Good. So she went through the full rounds of chemo, surgery, radiation, everything. And right after she completed her treatment, I had four discs go out in my back. And, you know, it was painful, excruciatingly. And so a lot of pain medications. And they said, we need to retire you because you cannot be attending secure briefings and, you know, writing reports and so on and perform your duties on the medications that you're having to take. So they medically retired me from my civil service position. I was a GS-13 at the time. Things were going great for the family. And then all of a sudden I was faced with, now I'm going to the pasture, and that's a significant amount of loss of income. So at the time, I think I was 70% rated with VA. I had to submit all the paperwork from the back situation, and that pushed me up to the 100% level. But there was still the civil service retirement that was processing. So it was an unsure period of our life. Kids were still in high school. And fortunately, that all worked out, and they medically retired me. But once we talked about this earlier, once you've been going so hard, so long, so fast, and all of a sudden you go to nothing, to zero, what do you do? And at the time, I had to have back surgery June 12th of 2012. And unfortunately, the doctor, won't mention name, but they botched that surgery severely. The hardware went in improperly, and they missed the cage spacers they put between the vertebrae, overshot with a bone graft matrix, like mortar between bricks. And that grew like a fist size rogue bone growth on the inside of my gut attached to the vertebrae. It took 4 years of battling that to get that corrected. You know, post-surgery, I had damage to the left side of the nerve, so I developed drop foot. So a lot of falls. Using a walker, couldn't mow the yard, couldn't do all the things I used to be able to do, except sit, you know. Not being able to walk and get around can do something to you as far as your motivation, your purpose in life. You start getting hopeless, you know. So fortunately, I couldn't stay down. You know, I got through that. I got through the walking. I got through, you know, regaining the ability to walk. Fought hard with Brooke Army Medical Center, with the chief of services there, and got back into surgery in 2017. Young surgeon who developed a new technique to go through the side with a sleeve. And he ripped out all the improperly placed hardware, fixed everything, took another surgery after that to repair the damage. So three surgeries. So... And then once you're labeled disabled, and this is something a lot of people deal with, and if you're forced to take pain medications the rest of your life, which I am, unfortunately, no one wants to hire you. You're unemployable in the traditional sense of getting an actual job at a brick and mortar type of setting or a company, so on. But as you know, being in real estate, there are other things you can do.
Sure.
And that was at the time that I decided I was not going to stay down. And I went and completed my education, got the history degree, and then got into writing science fiction and continued to do the things we talked about earlier, you know, with helping soldiers and other people, and just kept going. You know, you can't stay down. I used to tell my soldiers all the time, and I still use the saying, that even the strongest steel can bend, and even the strongest soldier at times, the strongest warrior must take a knee, only to recover, refit, regroup, and then rejoin the fight. You never stay down.
You know, the interesting thing what you're saying is, and you know, your story, you know, is very common to soldiers and all of the other services, and even everybody else out here, John Q. Public. I mean, there's people that go through this, and it's not so much about what's happened. It's just how you react to it, what you do with it, and where you come from that. And sometimes, you know, they say when one door closes, another one opens,
right?
So in your situation, do you feel like the things that you went through have helped you really focus more or really prepare more for the writing that you've always wanted to do?
Yes, absolutely. You know, once you realize what your limitations are, then you're not going to continue to focus a lot of energy on that. You redirect that into the new direction, into in this case, the writing. And so, I mean, I could show you files upon files, notes upon notes, the world building. You know, this is, I don't know if you can see it, that's just one notebook. And there's a lot that goes into writing for world building, and that's a whole hour conversation. I don't want to take us off time here.
Sure, but, no, you're fine.
But you also have to learn what you're going to do next. You know, I spent hours upon hours of watching videos that other authors who had made try to share how to do things. You know, Derek Murphy, Chris Fox. Chris Fox is a guy that writes, you know, science fiction and so on. And he was the guy that really cornered the market on the ebooks and was making like $300,000 a year plus, if I remember correctly, selling books that he was writing. So there is hope. And if you apply yourself into a new direction, you got to focus that energy there and quit trying to do things you can't do anymore. You have to learn your limitations and live with it.
You know, I tell everybody all the time, you know, the Marine Corps, they always say Semper Fidelis, you know, always faithful. And I always tell them the Army is more of a Semper Gumby, always flexible, right?
Yes.
So it's like, you know, we learn from that. You know, everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back with the final segment. I'm going to turn your story into a playbook. Practical moves for leaders who want to stay effective without losing themselves. But the main thing is, in this story, I want you to really realize that Alan's an example of leading yourself through hardships and still coming out on top. Be right back with Alan. Stay connected to the show and every Now Media TV favorite, live and on demand, anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. If you're on the move, you can catch the podcast version on www.nowmedia.tv. We're back in the final segment with Alan Cheeseman. He's an author, he's a former soldier, retired command sergeant major, and you know, family to me. As you guys know, I'm retired. I retired in 2002. But my parents, my dad retired, I retired. My son's retiring in 5 months. So there's life after military. And Alan is kind of an example of where you can go other than traditional work and still enjoy your life and build on. Alan, welcome back again.
Thanks.
So, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, all the challenges and all the obstacles that you've encountered and faced and overcome, you know, moving from the military, you know, the family, the your wife's health, your health, And, you know, one of the biggest challenges for soldiers, and I mean soldiers, all service members, is asking for help, you know, through your processes. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the help that you got in your direction with your writing. But what about other help, just the emotional strain that you were going through all the health issues? Was there some place you went to get or talk to get some help?
The short answer is no. And the reason
why
being,
was that?
It's prideful. You know, going back to our time in the military, then I'll jump into civilian life. As you rise through the ranks and you get to the senior level, you know, looking for help is supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be accessible. However, you know, there's a stigma that comes with that, even though there's not supposed to be, a stigma of weakness. And so when you're a senior leader or a soldier, you know, you're supposed to look strong and you don't want to look weak. So who do you turn to? You know, a lot of people have, especially with our 20 plus year, you know, war in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, PTSD they're dealing with. And so sometimes that can turn into, you know, substance abuse, alcohol, drugs. It can turn into divorce situations with the family, struggles. Fortunately, my wife and I are strong. In fact, we just celebrated our 40th anniversary in February.
Wow, congratulations.
She's strong. She hasn't put me in the ground yet.
Okay.
Even though I look for a shovel in the back of the truck when we get in. But anyway, so once I retired, and the only person you have is your spouse. You have to lean on them. They become your rock, your support. You know, my kids, you know, they're very resilient. As we talked earlier, they went from schools to schools to schools, sometimes moving every 2 or 3 years. And so you have your family support. And then you have those close network of friends that you have during your time in service. And I have those folks that I leaned on as well that we talked to, and they were going through their health issues as well. So I guess I didn't ask for help, but the help was there. And you have family and friends that close, that's great. But not everybody has that, unfortunately. You know, there are times that, you know, I'm sure you've had it in your time in service. We lose warriors to suicide. They give up on life. They feel overwhelmed. I've had that happen in my commands, you know, and you're left lingering with, you know, what could I have done differently? Why didn't I notice it? You know, what could I have done to prevent that? But sometimes you're so many echelons above that you don't see what really is going on. But to answer your question, no, I didn't really ask for help at the time. I had help that was there. I leaned on that. And then when I got into writing, there was help there with authors that I met that offered to mentor me and show me the way. And they're still doing it today, even 8 years after I began this journey.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's you sound like the typical do as I say, not as I do individual, right? And I know that it was a big transition for me. And that's part of the reason, you know, the show came to be Battle Ready. It's about not what happens, it's the journey. It's how you get to help, the resources that are out there. And you do a lot now in your community as far as providing resources for the other senior leadership to be able to actually reach out and mentor, you know, our young warriors as well as other people. And I think that's the amazing thing about it. But if you were to tell somebody now, look them in the eye and say, listen, would you tell them go look for help and know that the help's out there?
Yes, I still do that now with soldiers that I mentor. You know, there are people that are struggling daily. They hide their demons well. They put on a smile. And I tell them, go talk to someone. Go get help. Go see, you know, get some therapy. You know, I put my number out there. A lot of people don't like to put their personal information out there as far as email, you know, contact information. I put my phone number out there all the time, you know, especially within the senior leadership groups that I'm in. You know, you call me if you need to talk to someone. If it's the holidays and you're feeling down or whatever else, give me a call. You know, I'll be there. If I can't help you, I'll find somebody that can. You know, we do that with our kids because our kids go through hard times in life as they're growing and developing, you know, and they don't want to look weak to their parents, but still you gotta dig in. You know, what's going on? How can I help you? So I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, it does. So now that you said that, how can somebody reach out to you and continue a conversation or maybe even talk to you a little bit about your book that you're writing?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there's all my social medias, which I think you guys may provide. But if you need to reach me, my phone number is out there. It's publicly available. It's 830-832-1853. And it's alan.b.chessman@gmail.com. It's the same spelling you see on the on the screen.
So tell me this. You know, what do you do when the motivation is gone, but the mission still matters? I mean, how do you stay motivated in writing your book, although you love it? Is there every day that's like, I don't want to do this today?
There are some days that are good, some days that are bad. It depends on the workload. Because, you know, I've been working on this project now for 8 years plus. World building. I've built a world as big as, if you compare it to shows, as The Expanse on Amazon Prime, Battlestar Galactica, Stargate, right? And then Space Above and Beyond. I don't know if you remember that one or not. Sure. But all of those together, that's how big the world is that I have created. And it got so big at one point, it was daunting in 2023 when I put out the first manuscript draft for beta reading. And I got a lot of feedback. And one person, a friend of mine, Annette Elleraz, was so passionate about it. And she had published a fantasy book called Jewels of Smoky Quartz, about a female strong character. And so I asked her to join me as co-author. She actually lives in Israel, a former wow. IDF officer.
Actually, really?
Yeah, she's in the thick of it right now. But together, both of us, we meet every Saturday morning. We talk about it. We shoot, you know, chapters and scenes back and forth. We talk sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, just on chat, on Messenger, talking about ideas, about characters, different things, different things we haven't thought about or plot gaps we haven't analyzed and solved. But that keeps me going. It's creative. And I take that back to the early days of playing Dungeons and Dragons. I'm sure you remember that, right?
Oh, man, 80s. I had some soldiers that did that, man. They'd lock themselves in on Friday after work, and they wouldn't come up till PT on Monday.
I love that. I love that type of creativity. And that's what this affords me to do. I've created alien races. I've created new worlds. I've created new technology. And I made sure everything that I'm creating hasn't been created before. I do Google searches to make sure, has this type of technology been mentioned before? What about this type of planet? You know, what about this type of weapon system? And even my story concept, I've had the opportunity via email to chat with legends like David Brin, you know, the author of The Postman. Remember that movie?
Yes.
Oh, and he gave me great feedback on it, compared it to certain, you know, other existing works of fiction. He said, it sounds fun. Here's some advice. He's a great person. You know, Neil Stevenson, I met him up in Austin. A great friend of mine, Nicholas Ansbury Smith, he writes great apocalyptic fiction. His Helldivers series is phenomenal, and his Extinction Cycle. But those are just some of the guys that helped mentor me. But
you know, let me ask you this. You know, and I mean to cut you off, but have you ever heard of an author? The guy's name is Barry Sadler.
No.
It's not in the genre that you are in, but Barry Sadler was a former SF guy. That I don't know, you might know this because you're about my age, but you know the old John Wayne Green Beret movie,
right?
And the Silver Wings, the song, right. That Barry Sadler wrote that also.
Wow.
But the series is called Casca, CASCA. It's okay. About a Roman gladiator, a Roman soldier that's walking the earth. Anyway, I mean, it's just another example of a serviceman that has really went with their passion and build. I'm really looking forward to seeing your books. And man, I'd love to read a chapter or two if you ever available or allow me to do that. Just, you know, it's just the imagination, man. I'll hear you talk about it and your just your motivation about it. It sounds like you're just having a good time.
It's the creativity of it, you know. I even created food, the cuisine, you know, the beverages, you know, the home world for the primary characters in the story, you know. I'll give one spoiler. You know, the asteroid belt that we have between Mars and Jupiter is actually a planet 205,000 years ago, 205,000 years ago, called Kalninia. And there's a history of why it was destroyed.
It's in the story. Tell us about it. Oh, nice.
It's in the story.
Okay.
If you go out on YouTube, I created some videos for backstory and like storyboarding for the actual story itself. So I actually have a YouTube channel too. I'll share that information so it can be shared as well.
Well, that's amazing. So last, this is going to be quick. We got about a minute left. What are three signs someone is battle ready in a healthy way, not a survival way? And how do you, you know, apply that in what you do now?
You know, I saw that question and I thought about that. To me, someone who's battle ready is someone who knows their strength, their weaknesses, their limitations, and they're doing something to better themselves. You know, they're not going with the flow and letting life overwhelm them. And they're staying fit physically, mentally, morally. They're staying active in their community, staying active with their family. They're not becoming introverts. And, you know, they're living. They're not just surviving. Does that make sense?
100%. You know, thanks, Alan, for showing the reinvention looks like and what it's built on in discipline and honesty. I appreciate you taking the time to be on our show. Really look, tell me the name again of your series.
Phase World is a series. Phase World, A New Beginning is the title. And I'll share a blurb that you can post that as well so people can see that. The book is soon to be published. It has to go through a defense security review process. Something I recently found out that because of our non-disclosure agreements, everything I'm writing has Delta Force in it, has Space Force, it has Situation Room Briefs, you know, things that could be sensitive in nature, but is not classified information. But because of my former position as a senior military leader, it has to go through a defense pre-publication security review. There's an office that actually exists since 1949 that does that. And if you don't go through them, you'll wind up stat-based later on when they claim your book and prosecute you.
Well, listen, man, I know you're doing this well. I always appreciate talking to you, appreciate your leadership, and look forward to seeing you again and talking to you soon. Guys, welcome back to Battle Ready. And Alan Cheeseman, we hope you take time to watch our show tonight and give us some feedback. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye.